Good morning, everyone. So for those of you that don't know me, my name is Sai Ganesh, and some of you may be more familiar with seeing me on the stage as a singer, but today I'm hoping to share in a different way. When I was thinking about this reading, I was reminded of a story Swami Jyotish shared some years back that I was listening to on a video. For those of you, again, who don't know, Jyotish and Devi are spiritual directors of Ananda and all our work worldwide. And he was describing his first visit with Anandamoyi Ma. Anandamoyi Ma was a great woman saint who lived in India in the last century. And she had a close connection both with Yogananda and Swamiji later. And Jyotish was seeing her for the first time, and many members of Ananda had given him questions to take to Ma and ask her on their behalf. And he asked those questions, and Ma, again, as wise as she was, she responded to them. And once he was done, it was his friend's turn to ask questions. And this friend was actually an Indian lady who was herself a close disciple of Ma. And Jyotish was, when she started asking her questions, it all seemed a little unusual for him. Ma, I believe, had either given her or asked her to worship the small idol of Krishna. And she had a lot of questions related to that. She had questions like, what do I feed him? How many times in a day do I feed him? When I go out of town, do I take him with me or do I leave him home? And as Jyotish put it, never in a million years I would have imagined coming up with questions like that. And Ma, with all seriousness, she answered those questions in great detail. That's how he put it. She exactly told her what to feed him, how many times, and she said, I believe, you know, if you're just going to be out of town for a day or two, don't disturb him, he's fine by himself. But if you're going to be gone for longer, you want to take care of him, you don't want him to feel left out, so do take him with you. That story stood very vividly in my mind because during my own childhood, my grandmother used to worship this idol of Divine Mother. I think it was given to her by her guru. And sometimes we would travel to Mumbai, which was a 24-hour train journey, and my uncle lived there. And I remember her, you know, taking that idol with a lot of respect and care. And I remember this really pretty bamboo box in which she would wrap it in all these cloths and put it in. And it was not like a check-in baggage that you just sort of drop somewhere and pick up. She would always carry it with her with a lot of care. And then when it was the time for worship, she would open the box, she would set everything and do her puja. And it was very sweet to watch. I share these stories because for those of us in the West, and by that I don't just mean people born in the United States or people who grew up in the Western part of the world, I'm probably referring at large to most of my generation and perhaps even some of the previous generation, because we all grew up in the Western system of education and more or less share the same worldview. You know, such expressions of devotion or worship might seem a little unusual, and if you don't have a spiritual inclination, which is probably not any of you, it might seem a little childish, or in fact even superstitious. And if you do have a spiritual inclination and you understand the importance of devotion, it might look very poignant, but still not always easy for us to wrap our heads around outside of that specific cultural context in which it might be practiced. But the question that we still have to ask ourselves is, how do we bring that sweetness of devotion into our own life? How do you make that presence of God real, even if you're not carrying an idol of Krishna and feeding him three times a day all the time? And that's exactly what Krishna himself is answering in this reading. And you do that by cultivating and nurturing a deeply personal relationship with God. Some of you may be new, or if you've been around for a while, you probably have noticed that we pray a lot here at Ananda, and there is a very specific way in which we pray. We have a template. We always start by referring to Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, and Beloved. And it's not something any of us made up. It's exactly the way Yogananda prayed, and he taught us to pray. And that is to always start by making a personal connection with God. That is just so that all these ways in which we cherish human love, we cherish living this life with all the dear relationships and everybody and all the sweet ways in which we share the happiness in our own life. We can express that same sentiment towards the divine, and we can open our hearts and lift that energy upwards toward God. And this is just something amusing that happened to me not too long back. A few weeks back, I was on YouTube and I saw this video on my auto playlist. It said, "What is the best way to pray?" And it was a Sunday service given by Swami Kriyananda on the same topic. And immediately I thought, wow, this is a sign from the universe. I have to listen to this talk. I'm sure it has some inspiration for me. And I started watching the video. And as it often happens, I drifted away in 5 or 6 minutes onto something else. But I was conscious. And I made a mental note, you know, I have to come back and finish watching this video before I prepare for this talk. I'm sure this has something for me. And just this past week, as I was thinking more consciously about speaking today and what I wanted to share, I remembered that I have to go back and see this video. And I typed into Google, "What is the best way to pray?" And we all know Google reads our minds. It exactly knows at any point in time what's going on, what you're thinking about. And I was hoping that it'll be able to pull that video up for me. Interestingly, it took a few seconds, but what came up was not that video. It looked something different. And when I saw closely, it looked like a map. I was looking at it on my phone, and I started reading. It said, "Here is the best way to pray." And Pray was a small town in Montana. Who knew? And Google had pulled up the best way to pray. And it was going to take me 18 hours and 43 minutes to get there. It sounds really funny, but only too often we are so caught up in these linear ways of thinking that we end up missing the point. We are so attached to our own logical mind, and we somehow are always tempted to have to understand everything and to put all the pieces together. And we think God can be understood the same way, and we can put him in a box and we can get it all right. Well, I have good news and bad news. The bad news is, if the masters are to be believed and if you have to take the scriptures, the spiritual path is anything but linear. It is always contradicting itself, and it just cannot be understood with logic. But the good news is, once you have that experience of creating that personal relationship with God, once you're able to even make the smallest connection with your heart and feel for yourself what that looks like, then we start to realize that it's far more natural to approach God that way. And in fact, it's so much more simpler. And it's just the way we are made. Some of you know that I just got back from a trip to India. I was there for almost 4 weeks, and I got back a couple of weeks back. And while I was traveling in India, I went on a short pilgrimage. I mostly went to spend time with family. And I went to Kolkata and Puri and some of the holy sites around there. And while I was in Kolkata, I actually stayed in Belur Mat. This was the ashram of Ramakrishna, who was a great saint. Who lived in India in the late 1800s. He was actually much more than a saint. He was an avatar. An avatar is a fully realized soul, and their only reason for coming to this plane is out of compassion to liberate others. And while I was there, I had an opportunity to tune in more. And, you know, growing up in India, I had heard stories of his life, and I had read his biography and things like that growing up. Ramakrishna, in this incarnation, he was actually the head priest of a temple of Kali, a form of divine mother in the form of the goddess who grants liberation. That's in a place called Dakshineshwar, right outside Kolkata. And Ramakrishna, you know, performed all his duties as a priest, and he lived all his life in that temple campus. But he did much more than do all the rituals and rites at the temple. He conversed with Kali. His personal relationship with Kali was so intense and overwhelming that he literally lived with her every moment of his day. And it was not an image that was made with stone. It was a living presence that informed everything that he did in his life. So while I was there, you know, I was drawn to reread his biography and just feel, you know, what was he seeing in that image and what was the life that he was living? There's this wonderful book called The Gospel of Ramakrishna, which is perhaps the most authoritative biography of his, and it was written by Master Mahashaya, who some of you might remember from the autobiography of a yogi. And there are so many incidents and conversations that you read in that book that sort of give you a glimpse of how he was relating to Divine Mother and to the Divine. There is a story told of his first experience in cosmic consciousness. Ramakrishna himself was very devout and always was drawn to worship Kali. And at some point he reached a stage where he just couldn't bear that separation from Divine Mother. He just couldn't bear to see that he was stuck in this body and he could no longer be united with her. And just out of desperation, he walks into the temple and he sees a sword and he wants to throw himself on it and kill himself, thinking that getting out of the body would bring him closer to her. And he jumps, as he says, and then he falls on the ground and goes into the state of ecstasy that lasts for hours. And then one other day, people find him rolling on the banks of the river, and the disciples come and see, and there are rocks pricking all over his face, and it's bleeding. It's all red, and he's crying out aloud, you know, Mother, how could you do this to me? How could you not come when I'm calling out to you? I'm crying all the time, and how did you decide to even abandon me like that? And you sort of wonder, is this man crazy? What is he seeing? How is he relating to Divine in this kind of a way that's so passionate and personal? One morning he wakes up and tells his disciple, you know, yesterday she came to me. You know, she was this little girl. She was wearing these ochre-colored clothes and she looked so beautiful. And you sort of wonder what was the reality he was living in. And what was the... Is it even possible that Kali would come up to him as a girl and speak with him and that he would be able to converse in that fashion just like we converse with each other? And if it is possible, what was that power that he had that could freeze that infinite consciousness or the energy that pervades all of creation in every single atom into that tiny little human form? Well, that power is from the heart, and it's not just in Ramakrishna's heart, but in all our hearts, if we were able to tap into that. And I was just thinking through all this, and I, of course, visited the Dakshineshwar temple itself in Kolkata. And this was not my first time going to the temple, and I had a very interesting experience this time. And the temple itself is quite astral. I don't know if it's just me or everybody feels that way. It's unlike any other Hindu temple. It's quite peaceful. The grounds and the campus are large, and you can spend a lot of time there. And as you walk into the temple, you have to, there are these counters where you have to hand over everything you have. And this is not for spiritual reasons, although it might as well be. It's more for security reasons because of terrorist attacks and all the things that are happening in the world today. So, you know, and I was on a long pilgrimage and I had people with me, so I was always walking around with a lot of things, my phone, my wallet, my tickets, the keys, and you know, all the things that you're always holding on to. And I handed all that over at the counter, and you also have to, you know, if you've been to India and to Indian temples, you have to, there's also a counter where you deposit your shoes or slippers. And I walked into these metal detectors, and this man said, nope, there's something else in your pocket. You have to go find out what it is and give that in the counter, and only then you can walk through this. And there was something else, as he said, and I gave it. And I almost started smiling as I started walking into the temple. It felt so unreal in some sense that I was walking into this temple and I did not have anything. And it was a very hot and sultry day, so you could feel the fact that you were not wearing shoes. The granite was really hot, and you were always looking for shade to not have to feel the heat under your feet. But it almost felt somehow divinely appropriate that when I go meet my mother, I go just the way she sent me, not holding on to any of this, not bringing all the things that define us in this world all the time that we are so busy with, and that we keep ourselves occupied with. And The temple, you know, there's this pillared hall right opposite to the image of Kali. If any of you have been there, you probably understand what I'm talking about. And this is the place where, again, there's another story told in the autobiography of a yogi. When Yogananda himself went to the temple along with his sister and her husband, he meditated there, and he had an experience of that image coming alive, where he had this ecstasy or experience of feeling oneness with that image and with Kali. So I was already in a very uplifted state just being there and staying at the Ramakrishna ashram. And, I went around in the queue, had darshan of the deity, and went to meditate in this hall. And as I sat to meditate, it was almost instant that I was drawn into that presence of Divine Mother. And more than even the presence of Kali, you could really feel the tangible presence of Ramakrishna's devotion almost in every square in space of that temple. And the strangest thought crossed my head as I was meditating there. I was thinking, wow, this is what meditation should feel like. For a moment there, I actually ended up going there many times during my stay. But what I could feel perhaps for the first time, I don't quite remember, that there was really no self-effort. It was just so natural for me to be absorbed in that presence. It almost was like I was in front of the most beautiful being in the universe. And not only was this being the most beautiful, but she was actually my own mother. And just being absorbed in that presence and being there in front of Kali. And even after the meditation, it was just a strange time for me being in Kolkata for 3 or 4 more days. The only way I could describe it was just as though it was a magnet that was drawing me all the time back. In my itinerary, the schedule was really tight, and had planned to go spend this one morning in the Dakshineshwar temple, see everything that was around. And all the other days, I had other plans. I had to go visit this other place, and then I had to go somewhere else. But somehow, things kept rearranging themselves, and I kept going back, and then I kept going back, and then I kept going again and again. Almost every day I was there after my first visit. And it was so interesting for me, just traveling with that sense of always knowing that I would get to go to that temple again. I was always aware of where the temple was in relationship to where I was in Kolkata. Sometimes I was miles away. And if I was south, I always knew that, oh, I'm facing east. And if I was facing north, I would be facing the Dakshineshwar temple. And even when I would get into a bus, I would always be aware, if I sit in this seat, as the bus is moving, I would be facing that temple. So I share this experience that I had because sometimes that personal relationship with God brings us closer and gives an experience of the divine which no amount of intellectual understanding can. And the power that we have in our own hearts to draw divine close to us that way is unlimited. There's this beautiful recording of Master's voice, some of you might have heard it on YouTube, of him reciting this Bengali poem to Kali. And in this poem, he's actually speaking as though Divine Mother is speaking. He says, you know, if you ask liberation of me, I would give it to you easily. That's not a big deal. But you know, you can't ask devotion. Because once I give you devotion, then I've given myself, and then you have command over me. And I was thinking of that poem again and again as I was thinking of Ramakrishna and his experiences with Kali, because that's really what he had. Because he could freeze Divine Mother in these forms. He could converse with her. He could make her presence a reality in his life in a way that seems so unreal to us. For all of us who are so busy in this world, certainly preoccupied with a lot of things all the time. And, that power of the heart, what this personal relationship with the divine gives us is that openness, is the ability to open our own hearts to receive that love. Every week we come up in the purification ceremony and we say these words, you know, by the grace of God. What do we say? I seek purification by the grace of God. You know, today as I was saying it, the response was so vivid in my ears, perhaps because I was just thinking about this topic so much more consciously. Open your heart to me and I will enter and take charge of your life. And how simple that sounds in a way. And more interestingly, once you meditate with the person who's blessing you, you hear the words, by the grace of our masters, you're free. And it is worth thinking about it a little bit more. You know, we went to the altar saying, I seek purification by the grace of God. So it would probably seem more obvious if the minister said, by the grace of God, you're free. But interestingly, they say, by the grace of the masters, you're free. And you wonder, I did not come here seeking the master. Well, that's not how we feel, but but it's worth noting. And I'm not here implying everything is the grace of God. Every single atom in creation is the grace of God. So I'm not implying anything else. But the words are worth noting, because what we are hearing in those words and what we are being told is that it is hard, if not impossible, to relate to God in the abstract. And God comes to us through that personal touch. When we seek truth, when we seek the presence of God, when we seek that infinite consciousness, we cannot really get very far in the abstract. And the Guru comes as a response to that prayer. And what really liberates us is that personal touch. And that comes when we open our hearts to that personal connection we have with that one soul that has been drawn to us as the channel for our own liberation. And all that is being asked of us is that we make that the center of our life. We make that personal connection real as much as we can as we move through our life. Because it is the subtle spark that we hold in our hearts, and we move around in the world, and everything else that we have, that is the nature of delusion, that it is always trying to extinguish that flame. And the more we can hold on to that awareness, the more we can keep bringing our focus back. How Ramakrishna lived in this world is still something that has a lot to teach us today. You know, to have to always be in connection with Divine Mother and still discharge the duties of this world. That is how Lahiri Mahashaya lived. We all know from the autobiography of a yogi that he could be a householder. He could be an avatar. He could be fully liberated, and he could be absorbed in the divine all the time and still perform the duties of the world and still always be aware of that connection with God. I want to share one more. This is probably not recent, but a YouTube video that I saw some time back. You must be thinking, I spend a lot of time on YouTube, which is not untrue. But this was a video, actually, of, it might seem like a digression, of a chef in Thailand. And this was a young lady who had become very well known at a young age. And it was like this short piece or documentary where somebody was following her, showing how she cooks and all her skills in the kitchen. And this interviewer was asking her questions, and she was responding to him, and the voiceover was behind as we were seeing her doing different things. And to some question that the interviewer asked, she said, you know, people sometimes ask me, what am I doing? What do I do when I'm not cooking? Meaning, do I have hobbies? Do I travel? Do I read books or do other things like that? And I tell them, when I'm not cooking, I'm still cooking. And that's because being a chef is not a job I do. It is who I am. And, you know, English was not her first language. So she was trying best to express what she wanted to say and what her state of mind was. But I thought, wow, what could be a better way to state it? And it just all seemed so appropriate. And for all of us, as those seeking God, as disciples, as devotees, I was trying to apply that same philosophy or principle to my own life. What am I doing when I'm not meditating? What am I doing when I'm not praying? When I'm not praying, I'm still praying. Because I might not be closing my eyes or folding my hands or standing in front of the altar, but I want to always live with that awareness of that personal connection with God as my mother, with God as the guru. And this connection is defining and informing everything I do. And that is that central self-identity that we always want to hold on to. Because meditation and prayer is not something we do, it is who we are. A child of God, a disciple of a great guru, a Kriyabana, a yogi, is who we are at the center of our own being. And the more we can hold on to that identity and the more we can live in that awareness, the closer we come to God. God bless you all.